The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cricket Podcast with me, Jack Hope, Ross Legg. How are you, Ross?
Hi, Jack. Yep, very well, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. And Max Rowe Brown. How are you doing, Max Rowe Brown?
Yeah, also very well, thank you.
Good. On this week's episode of the Cricket Podcast, we have a two-part show. In part one, we'll be talking England. They completed a 2-0 series win over Sri Lanka and took home the Moose Cup. Freed of the burden of a Trump presidency, Joe Root is great again, and James Anderson is pretty handy too. Then, in part two, we will be taking you to the IPL. This week, we found out which players each franchise will be retaining for the 2021 season, and who they have released. We'll be having a little chat about what that means for each franchise's draft strategy. But first, it's our first question of the week. And in reverence to the Moose Cup or Moose Trophy, whichever one it is, the one with the antlers, we will be asking each other about trophy design. So boys, my question...
It sounds exciting. I can't wait to get to it.
It's quite a simple question. If you were in charge of commissioning a trophy for a test series, which brand would you recruit as a sponsor, and how would you integrate that design into the trophy? Max?
So, for me, right, I don't know if you remember the little bobblehead toys you got as a kid of like your famous sportsmen. So I'm thinking Corinthian Toys, who made these little figurines, would be the sponsor of this trophy, and they could incorporate their famous bobblehead design into the trophy. So I just really like the idea of Joe Root stepping up today to go and collect his series trophy that's moulded in the shape of Joe Root with a giant head.
You know, that's
yeah,
the board.
That's a well thought through.
I've got like the Michael Atherton one, which I had as a kid. I had a Jack Russell one as well. So I just like the idea of a little bit of self-serving player of the series get a trophy that's yourself.
I was just thinking the Border Gavaskar trophy. We got two heads looking at each other, just both wobbling in front of each other.
Well, there you go. So you don't even need to change the name of half of them.
That's Max. That's well thought through. It has a clear USP. I think the players would love it. Who wouldn't love a giant bobblehead of yourself in your bedroom? Ross?
I've stayed with the bust. So for KFC, they sponsor all kinds of things in cricket. I think they were even sponsored some of the stuff in South Africa recently. And I think they sponsored some of the stuff in the BBL. Can you imagine having a big bust of the Colonel? You go up, celebrate with the BBL trophy. Big bust of the Colonel.
I'd rather have a bargain bucket.
Yeah, you could have a bargain bucket one. That's
edible trophies.
Or Lego, which Lego's a classic, isn't it? And you could all different parts. Fine, it's sustainable. You can change. It goes around different ones.
Yeah, I thought Lego. I'm going to claim that you've stolen my idea there.
Okay.
And I've just had to come up with this on the fly, which is a much worse idea. I thought IKEA could maybe do a line in the trophy business. I think particularly for away teams, but maybe one of the reasons, I was just sort of thinking this through. In Test cricket, it's apparently becoming harder to win away from home. And I was thinking maybe one of the reasons for that is that the away team don't want to have to take the trophy home on the plane. I mean, they're all I mean, the Moose Cup, how's that going to fit in a cargo hold? That you have to buy.
EasyJet are going to charge you through the nose.
Yeah,
for that,
exactly.
Aren't they?
No such problem with IKEA's flat pack trophies.
Very nice.
You can flatten
it fits
them down
under your airline seat.
Yeah, it fits into the captain's hand luggage.
Yeah,
and he can keep his book or whatever tablet. I don't know. I don't know. What does Joe Root do on the plane? That's a good question. We will ask him if we. If we ever speak with the great man. Anyway, Max, I think your idea was the best. I also think Lego being integrated into trophies would be good. And
you had an idea too, so well done for that.
Ross, what do our listeners need to know before we get on with the rest of the show?
They should be following us on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, at The Cricket Pod. We've now breached the video game as well as the podcast game, so check out our YouTube channel and subscribe. Want to say thank you to Cricket For Us and Red Hand for the love on Apple reviews. Thank you very much for your 5 stars. Keep them coming and we will read them out. And also tell a friend. The only way this podcast grows is by getting it out into more people's ears. So share it and follow us on social media.
Thank you, Ross. It's been growing well recently, so once again, thank you to our mainly very happy Indian fans who joined us last week for the first time. We will take a quick break and then we will be back with a test match from Sri Lanka.
I can't wait to get you to the Gabaresh. Tell you what. I can't wait to get you to the Gabaresh. Tell you what.
It's full, it's down the ground, there'll be at least one. Saini has got an injury with the groin. It goes as far as the fence. India, incredible. Rishabh Pant is the star. India win the test.
Yeah, so we're starting with England series over Sri Lanka. They have secured a 2-0 win in the series after wrapping up a 6-wicket win inside 4 days at Gaul. I'll be running through a few questions with the lads here. And first, Max and Jack. The test match had some pleasing twists and turns along the way, but was this a game that England won or a game that Sri Lanka lost?
I think England won this game more than they won the first one. If that makes sense. I mean, we saw in the first test, Sri Lanka basically threw it away within the space of about the first 30 overs by trying to play 3 reverse sweeps, at very inopportune moments, and Don Bess securing the most ridiculous 5 for he'll or anyone is ever likely to see. In this one, we saw England actually having to graft a bit more. We had Joe Root's double century sort of propping up England's innings a bit. Sri Lanka, Embledenia took a lot of wickets. They actually put together a proper batting display, once anyway. And we had to graft a bit on the fourth day to chase down that 164. So I think more of a win than the first one, but still, it still owes a degree of gratitude to the Sri Lankans in some aspects.
I think, Ross and Max, that's a binary question. And you're right to ask it, Ross. We live in a binary world. People like black and white answers. Unfortunately, I'm a man of nuance.
A man in the grey.
Yeah. And I think it was a bit of both. I think that Sri Lanka going into day 4, so this morning, less than 24 hours ago, were in position to win this test match. They went into the fourth day, 42 runs ahead of England. England still batting. They needed to take 1 wicket. They wrapped that up reasonably quickly. And then, it was a miserable batting performance from Sri Lanka. Max, as you alluded to, I don't think it was quite as bad as the first innings of the first test, but it wasn't a million miles away.
They did get fewer runs in this innings.
Yeah, I mean, it was look, they get day 4 credit, don't they? Because it happened on day 4, but okay. There were a lot of big shots from the Sri Lankan batters, and it could have been a lot worse as well. Embledenia, Lemon Land, he contributed with 40 or 40 balls, which bailed them out, really, and actually ended it left England needing 164, which was a competitive-ish score, if not particularly fantastic. But I don't know to what extent Sri Lanka's collapse this morning on the fourth day was due to England being exceptional or due to Sri Lankan stupidity.
Incompetence.
Yeah, incompetence.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that fourth innings where England kind of chased down. I mean, Max, you and the guy from Gorilla Cricket or Bear would definitely be, oh, England are going to lose this when we had a small target of, what, 160 odd. But actually, the Sri Lankans' approach to kind of their fielding and wicket taking strategy was lacking, wasn't it?
I think so. Yeah, they got England into a spot of bother. You know, we were four down and had just lost Joe Root, who pretty much carried England in every other innings in this series. Dom Sibley was there on a decent score on his first decent score of the series.
He was
on about
4 from 500
struggled.
Deliveries, wasn't he?
I think you're giving him doing him a little bit of a disservice. But he was a man under a bit of pressure after his performances in the first few games, and I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about him and how he seems to have tried to change things up a bit. But yeah, there was definitely we were definitely looking at a situation where another wicket and England, you know, they were then into Sam Curran, and suddenly it looks like 164 looks a little bit further away than it was, but they didn't put any pressure on after that point. And I think it was just particularly Dom Sibley who, you know, being under all that pressure, they just let him work really simple singles. And that was just, I couldn't begin to understand what the plan was, because it's a fourth day pitch. We've seen it turn. You've got a left arm spinner spinning it away from the right hander. Bring, you know, have a ring, get tight on the singles. And if he wants to drive you through the covers to get the runs, by all means, go for it, because it's, you know, he'll edge one. It will happen. It will spit. And there seemed to be no sort of defined plan on how to get it. And they just sort of gave up after a bit by the looks of it.
I actually think in this match that was probably the big point of difference between the two sides. I don't think necessarily, the big point of difference between the two sides was Joe Root, let's be honest. But but then after that, I think the major reason that England came out of this test with the victory was their plans. And that extends to the lines they bowled and the field places they set and so on. Do you remember before Christmas, Max, when we spoke with Jarrod Kimber?
Yes.
Do you remember when we were talking with him and we were talking about how England use analytics, and he was able to give us some examples. He obviously doesn't work for England, but he said, based on what he's seen, how England play, the area where the use of analytics is most obvious for England is with their bowling plans. And I think this match really was the perfect illustration of that. They didn't bowl too many overs, even in the first innings, on the first day when it was flat as fuck. They didn't bowl too many overs, or they didn't try too many plans that didn't seem to make sense. Everything they did posed some sort of a challenge. Even if the challenge was as basic as, how are you going to score at more than three and over here? They kept at whatever they were doing to each batsman really well. They were patient, and basically that meant that where there was a skill differential, England were able to exploit that. So in the first innings, that was Anderson's ability to control his line and length and basically outweight the Sri Lankan batsmen when it came to taking some of those wickets. Not all. Some of them were just really good bowling, but some of them were to do with patience. And some of that was around Mark Wood and the lengths he was bowling and the way he bowled. And it was good to see Mark Wood take some wickets. But it's I think in this game, the groundwork put in by the analysts and the planning and probably the work that Joe Root and Chris Silverwood have done to work up these plans, is the reason that England were able to find success and limit Sri Lanka when they were on top and exploit them pretty ruthlessly this morning on the fourth day.
Well, it was interesting, right? Because this is apparently the first time in history that that all first innings wickets were taken by seamers and then all second wickets were taken by spin.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was the exact plan, to be honest.
That's what the computer said. The computer said, bowl Jimmy Anderson, he'll take six for. It'll all be fine, bowl Leach your best.
But I think you did, you were able to watch what England were doing in both innings and say, it's pretty obvious how they think they're going to get the guy out here, or how they're going to think they think they can stop him scoring runs. Whereas with Sri Lanka, Max, you're absolutely right. I mean, they had like five boundary fielders for Dom Sibley. Dom Sibley doesn't
defending, defending 160. Like,
what do they think he's going to do?
Well, so Jack, you touched upon kind of what England got right, so the Jimmy Anderson experience and using Mark Wood relatively effectively. What did they get wrong? I mean, on the first innings, as we said, there was no wickets falling to the spinners. Was that something that... What's going on there?
So if I was going to give you a cop-out answer, I'd say the pitch was a bit flat.
It was pretty dead on the first day.
Yeah, and I think, again, these are passages of play that England, the England cricket team, and us as watchers of the England cricket team will have to get used to, I think, over the next 2 months, because there will be days in India where if you take five wickets and keep the Indians under 270 for the day's play, you'll have achieved a victory. And it won't necessarily feel like it at the time, but you will have. And I think... To some extent, although I think probably you'd say Sri Lanka had the better of day one, it wasn't a runaway victory for them. So why did England do badly? I don't think they did as badly as it maybe looks on paper. And I think you can explain a large amount of that away by saying the pitch was flat, even if it is a bit of a cop-out answer. I don't know. What do you think?
Max, I think on the WhatsApp, you mentioned that It takes a little bit of time for Leach and Best to kind of warm up, to kind of start hitting their stride a little bit. Is that a thing? Because, I mean, that's not going to be the case when you've got kind of Ashwin kind of bowling at you. He's on it from ball one.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that more from the point of view that in particularly Leach's case, he's not played much cricket at all. And, you know, in that first test in particular, they were coming in from a bit cold, not a lot of preparation. And you know, You can understand that it might have taken them a bit longer. In this case, you know, you want to be going into the game slightly hotter. And they do, you know, people talk about a lot with spinners as a batsman. You don't want to let them settle. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it takes them time to settle. But I think what England did well in the fact that their spinners weren't taking wickets is that they had, as Jack said, they had plans and they executed other plans. And Mark Wood, in particular, actually getting the ball to reverse a bit towards the end of the that old ball. Mm-hmm. And I think it was one wicket in particular that was a bit of late swing in LBW, which is a lovely reverse. You love that wicket, don't you? It's so exciting. It's like back to the days of Wassim and Wacker. So it's just nice to see England have a few more strings to their bow.
Well, I agree with that, and I think it was quite interesting as well. I mean, Sri Lanka, we touched upon. Their second innings was a bit of a mishmash of weird and interesting shots, but they demonstrated in the first innings that they could apply themselves. I mean, Matthews hit a century, which we're not any of us are shocked about, but he always loves scoring runs against England. Chandamal batted well, Pereira batted well, and Dick Weller moved into second place on a very coveted position. Do you know what that position is?
Most runs without a century in Test history.
Correct.
He's now behind Shane Warne.
Correct, yeah, very good. 74 innings, an average of 30, and he currently sits about 1,000 runs behind Shane Warne. He's about 2,300.
Well in his sights there, I think.
I wanted to tee up kind of talking about Dick Weller, because he was kind of at the heart of the chat, which because of the lack of crowd and the lack of crowd noises, we're seeming to pick up a bit more kind of banter between the batsman and the fielding side. Did any of you have any favourites or pick up any of the bits that Dick Weller said to the English bats?
No, I did. He did do one, didn't he, to Sibley? Have you? I mean, I'm assuming you're doing this having to tee yourself up to joke boy.
that's my designated role on the podcast, joke boy. I was just wondering. So he asked Joe Root for his bat, which I thought was pretty good. He ribbed Johnny Bairstow for being dropped for the India tour, The England are saying that he's being rested, which is fine. But he'll happily take the IPL contract fee, which I thought was quite a good ribbing. And then Dan Lawrence in his second Test match, he was asking him to teach him some shots. He was unbelievable at cricket. And then the final one was asking Sibley if he was going to be in the Test team for India. I think that's perfectly fine of the game. I think most people would enjoy that, right? It's not kind of obtuse sledging, is it?
I think it was fine.
Yeah, it's a different level, isn't it? It's not that in your face Aussie,
like break your arm.
We're gonna kill you kind of thing. It's just a little. It's cheeky, isn't it? Cheeky sledging. Yeah. That's my kind of sledging.
It's the vaguely threatening stuff the Australians do that is why people think it's not okay. Like, sometimes it's overt threats, like, I'm going to break your fucking arm, or get ready for a broken fucking arm. Yeah. Sometimes it's can't wait to get you to the Gabba. It's like, why can't you wait to get them to the Gabba? Like, it's not...
Because I'm really bored of being Australian captain and I want it to end.
It's not... Tim Payne wasn't saying that because he was excited to see Ashwin again. He wasn't like, it's so much fun playing cricket with you, Ashwin. Like, can't wait to see you next week. It was darker... Dark undertones to it. No, it was all right, wasn't it, Dick Weller?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Max, his cheeky nature reminded me of you, actually. If you were a wicketkeeper, I think you'd be Dick Weller. Anyway.
And if I were a Test cricketer, I probably wouldn't be scoring any centuries. So, again.
Nailed it. When it comes to England's batting, so we've touched upon it a little bit, and Dom Sibley's kind of second innings. He is awful to watch, though, isn't he? He's absolutely... His face is like Phil Jones-esque. He doesn't really know what to do with his face when he's batting. And he's very rigid. Like, the fridge is rigid. Has he actually worked out how to play spin bowling, or was he just fortunate? Because, I mean, there was three umpires' call decisions that went his way.
I don't think... Right, so there is quite a lot to discuss here, isn't there? One, we need to be really clear that Dom Sibley was lucky to get 50 today. Called Pujara lucky on last week's podcast. People weren't happy with that. In just the same way as Pujara was lucky to not be out LBW, in almost exactly the same way, in fact, actually, Dom Sibley was lucky to not be out LBW.
No, it wasn't clipping leg stump, was it?
Having said that, I think it was obvious that Sibley has made some positive changes in the last, 2 weeks, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an example of why he's been pretty successful, or reasonably successful, in Test cricket so far. You have to say, in the first three innings he played in Sri Lanka, he didn't look very good, and he looked like he didn't really know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. In this match, even though he might have an ugly technique, it was clear that he had a game plan and he was doing something a little bit differently. His weight transfer back and forward was a lot better. Was he perfect? No, he was not perfect. But that version of Dom Sibley can probably be an effective operator in those kind of conditions. Like, I don't think he's going to be scoring centuries and winning your matches like Joe Root, but he's moved out of the category of walking wicket if he plays like that, because it was tricky. And I think sort of counterintuitively, because people don't do it in this country, but facing the new ball against spin in Sri Lanka is hard, because the ball's a little bit harder, it goes through the surface a bit more, the seam's a bit stronger and then the ball leaps. But he actually, he did all right. I think he did all right. He said after the game, didn't he, that he actually came into the series feeling pretty confident, and then after the first test felt pretty bad, and then went to the nets and did quite a lot of work. So it's encouraging that he has a pretty strong understanding of his own game and how he can react to the flaws that he identifies.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think there's another aspect as well to sort of the playing spin in Sri Lanka that you need to consider, which is starting against spin. It's not something that these England players do very often at all. They'll play spinners in the county championship and they'll play on pitches that spin, but it's just it's a different experience having to start your innings against spin. And you don't even have to sort of look at Test cricket to experience that. Like, if you ever played club cricket and played timed cricket, And, you know, you go in and you're playing, you're batting second, and they're using the old ball and they open with spin. And it's a nightmare. So, yeah, you know, it's just from personal experience, for once that you can equate to professional elite cricket, it's a different different side of things, both mentally and in terms of the skills required. And it takes a little bit of getting used to. And I think there were enough signs there that he's got the ability to do that.
Nope. Absolutely.
In a short space of time as well.
Yeah, I think in English cricket, basically you use a spinner in first class cricket anyway, when nothing else has worked. It's not usually plan A. And in this case, it very much was plan A and B.
Unless you're Essex and have Simon Harmer in your team, then it's reasonable.
Yeah, even then though, they're giving you like 25 overs of Jamie Porter and Sam Cook to soften the ball up, and that'll be moving all over the place. I mean, so they will use Harmer more than some clubs, but it's probably still their backup plan.
So let's stay with spin. Emble Denier bowled reasonably well. Root was pretty much unaffected by him. He threw down 247 deliveries to him, didn't get him out, and was hit for 200 runs. So it's pretty good from Rooty. However, England's other batsmen didn't do particularly well. So I've got a question: is Lemonland is it the translation from? Tamil, I'm guessing, to English.
Sinhalese, maybe?
Yeah, quite possibly. Is he any good?
It's one of those two. Yeah.
Is he any good, or did we make him look a bit better than he is?
Well, Max, you think
go
he's
on,
good.
Jack, you go. No, Jack, you go
no,
first.
No, because you have to say why he's good, so I can say why he's bad.
Right. Well, I think you have to look at it in context. And I think he did a decent job. I think he was certainly the pick of Sri Lanka's bowlers. He looked threatening, particularly with the new ball. And that's evidenced by the fact that he got most of England's batsmen out at some point. He did leak a few runs, which is probably a concern. But I think some of that might also be down to just general, like the plans. We spoke about how Sri Lanka set up, and you know, there are two sides to building pressure on a team. One of which is bowling in the right areas, which I think by and large he did, and another one is having the right plans in the field. He's not blown anyone away. Let's not get carried away. But he's certainly done a lot better than the previous, I think, 8 tests he's played before then. Yeah, he's shown that he's got a lot more about him than perhaps the previous stats have suggested.
Right, so Max, basically
your turn.
Your central argument here is that Emble Denyer is good because Emble Denyer used to be really, really bad.
No, I'm saying Emble Denyer has clearly shown improvement from his previous experiences, and you know, he had a decent series, took a lot of wickets.
No, okay, so we have to accept that he did take a lot of wickets. In the Cricket Podcast WhatsApp, I have been throwing around the term pie chucker to describe Emble Denyer, and I think, you know, on balance, he probably, by the standards of cricket or good bowler to pie chucker, he's probably not in the absolute pie chucker category, is he? I mean, like, he's not going to do a Dom Sibley, a bowl it halfway down and sort of second slip. However, I think by international standard bowlers, he probably falls into the bad category. I would be surprised if he ever gets much better than this, and I don't think that this is particularly good. I think if you look at the conditions he's bowling in, it's probably the best possible scenario for him, in that he's bowling at home in Sri Lanka, where he knows the conditions. He's bowling... England's top six are all right-handers. So there's no left-handers for him to bowl to at all. And at least two of them, until maybe Sibley made some corrections, but at least two of them have some pretty serious issues against spin. I don't really think. I mean, like, what were his figures for the whole series, Ross? You broke it down into Root and everyone else.
He took 15 wickets.
15 wickets at for how many runs?
Why don't you do some quick maths? 400. The average was 27.66.
Yeah, I mean, that. So I think that in and of itself is not particularly good. Yeah, I mean, you also have to factor in that it's England. I mean, we're talking about probably, Maybe New Zealand see less spin in their domestic game. None of these players really know these conditions. They milked him basically. Mm. I mean, mate, Joe Root was the chief milker, as we've discussed. But that there still runs against you. So you know, like in summary, I think Embledenia, people were happy or excited about Embledenia basically because the rest of the bowlers were so bad.
That is fair. But I mean, I'd counter that by saying that his figures, as we've mentioned, are blotted by the fact that Joe Root was in extremely, extremely imperious form for the whole series.
Yeah, but you can't. That's
and
not how
he
it
is
works.
A top. But he's no. He's a top. He's top class player, and he was in form, and he is a fantastic player of spin, and. Yeah,
you can't say I'm good.
He struggled against him.
You can't say I'm good as long as no one else good turns up.
No, it's what I'm saying is like you think about the matchups, right? And compared to other England players who are not in the top tier, he did well. And then against the top tier, he did badly. So he probably sits somewhere between those tiers, i.e. not pie chucker. Okay.
Almost every other team in the world is going to bring someone good, if not more than one player good with them. I just don't see... What's Embledenia going to do that's better than that against the perfect team for him to bowl? I mean, like, who's going to turn up and do worse than England? Maybe West Indies? Anyway, look, Embledenia, let us know. What do you think?
The worst player ever to take a test match temper. someone should, though, Max, just before, teach him the no ball rule. And I think they should teach Sri Lanka's spin bowlers the no ball rule, as it was... pretty embarrassing. There's 14 in the test match.
Unforgivable, isn't it? Unforgivable.
Anyway, what did we actually learn from the test series of the horse? I think we've covered the test match itself. From the series, though, what did we learn? And I'm going to start with the first question around Folks versus Butler, Max. As it seemed to go all right for Butler this series.
Yeah. Butler had a decent series. Got his first ever stumping. Congratulations to him. That's a big, big tick in the checkbox list of things you should probably be able to do as a test match wicketkeeper. Batted reasonably well, scored a good 50 and looked solid today when it was needed. So I think, yeah, overall successful tour for Butler. I think what I find a little odd about the whole Butler Folks thing is that England, yeah, they've got this rest policy and they've said already that Butler will play the first test of India and Folks will play the last three. Mm. Which suggests to me that they're obviously aware that Folks is the best wicketkeeper because they're playing him in the hardest games, but they're also just throwing him in cold after Butler played in Sri Lanka. So I don't really understand. And for me, I mean, Dan Lawrence came in and he had one good innings and then looked a bit shaky aside from things. If they're that intent on getting Butler in the team, which they obviously are because he is a phenomenal batsman, why not just play Butler as a batsman and have Folks keep, and then you don't have to worry about, you know, like him going into India for those last three tests and, you know, being caught a little bit cold. Maybe at least give him one game in Sri Lanka to kind of get a feel for things.
Yeah, I think Butler's going to be a big loss when he goes, isn't he? He's transformed himself from.
You've changed your tune.
Well, Butler's changed his performance.
That's what happens after a transformation. Yeah, I'm not gonna look at that and be like, oh, we don't want a guy who averages 55 in the team.
He was on the precipice.
I liked Butler before he was cool, mate. I liked Butler before he was cool. But anyway, sorry, I cut over you there, Jack.
No, I think he'll be a big loss. That's the point. I think at this moment in time, you're wrong if you think Folks should be in the team instead of him.
I'm now saying as well.
Okay, yeah. We've moved you on the dial. That's it. What I also liked about, and Max, you mentioned Butler's innings, but also Johnny Bairstow's innings. I think it was clear that the ODI and IPL pressure cooker had actually produced a different type of England batsman, so a different mentality actually going out and playing your shots in what easily could have been old England and bowled out for 80. So I was quite impressed on that. Openers, we've already talked about Sibley to death. Zach Crawley, does he retain his place in the upcoming tour for India in a starting berth?
I think it would be slightly mental if they got rid of him. because he had a bad series in Sri Lanka.
He'll bat it three, won't he? Because Johnny Bairstow's been rested.
We've sort of talked.
So I assume that's what will happen.
We've sort of talked about the England batting lineup a few times on this show and how it's better structured if there are three people capable of opening in the top three. And this is probably why Bairstow doesn't stay in the team, even though he played quite well in Sri Lanka. In my mind, Bairstow's competing for one of the stroke maker roles in the team, and he isn't better than Root, he isn't better than Stokes, and he isn't better than Butler. So you can't, you can maybe fit him in instead of Pope or Lawrence, where I think they're kind of interchangeable, but I don't think he gets in ahead of the engine room, if you like, of the England middle order. Mm-hmm. And then that leaves the top three, which in the English summer did a really good job overall of setting up Root, Stokes and Butler. And I think messing around with that formula too much is why England were rubbish for quite a long time. not rubbish, but you'd have these players, and we've
won games, but we were 50 for four every time.
Yeah, we've seen games where we've seen Stokes dominate teams, we've seen Root dominate Sri Lanka here and dominate many teams in the past. Butler's come to the party now, and the thing that was missing though was any kind of a platform or plan to enable that. And everyone would always say, oh, it would be great one day when XYZ gets to come in and the score would be blah, blah, blah for blah, blah, blah. And it never happened. it didn't happen for 50 tests because we were trying them. it was just a revolve. It was a circus at number three.
Yeah.
Like everyone got to go there. Stokes had to go there. Moeen Ali had to go there. But Bairstow had to go there. And I think Crawley...
Sam Curran probably had to go there.
Crawley, does he solve England's... Is he Crawley 267 Crawley, or is he Crawley 20 runs for the series Crawley? Probably neither. He's probably a slightly better than Joe Denley English number three. I imagine someone better than him will come along at some point. Maybe that'll be Dan Lawrence. Maybe that'll be Ollie Pope. And there could be some questions about his place in the team. But for now, for the next year, who is a better option as one of those opening three? And who's a better option than Sibley, and who's a better option than Burns? And I think those three as a combination give you a lot of insurance and set up the rest of the team so nicely that you would have to be Ed Smith to want to break that up. So I imagine in a couple of weeks' time, it will be Moeen Ali at number three.
So you mentioned Sam Curran in there, maybe not in his usual position batting at number three. What do we think about that fifth spot in that England lineup? Is Sam Curran the right person to have there? We're obviously going to change it for India. Was it worthwhile having that person in there, or should we have taken a bat? Or is it a moot point?
Well, I think in terms of when Jack was talking about the revolving door and keeping things consistent, that's probably the one position where you could have a bit of a revolving door and mix things up a bit, especially depending on who you're playing against. So, you know, Sam Curran does a job when the ball's swinging a bit and he's a clever bowler and he offers something with the bat most of the time. Didn't do much this series, but it didn't matter. Chris Wokes, we all know what he can do, especially at home. They're probably not too dissimilar. You could bring in Moeen Ali and have an extra spinner if it's a spinning pitch. I think that's probably the one bit of the team where you can afford a bit of flexibility and be a bit more creative about your selections.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Curran that's becoming probably slightly more obvious is that he is very rarely the best choice for any particular condition. However, he is often not the worst choice. So if you, that sounds, I don't know how well that came across.
But so you're basically saying if you're not sure how things are going to turn out, he's a safe
exactly.
bet.
So I think in English conditions, when you're pretty sure it's going to seam around, Chris Wokes is a banker over Sam Curran. But if it's going to be sunny, maybe you're playing at the Oval where it's a bit flatter, Sam Curran can do a few things that Wokes can. I mean, like he's left-handed, which is something that Wokes can't do.
Hey, you don't know that. We've not asked him. Chris Wokes could do anything.
So he gives you that. He gives you that little point of difference, which means that he will be able to ask some questions. I don't love him, and I don't think he should. You should be, if you're an England selector, you should be trying to build your team around Sam Curran. But he will usually contribute something. And he can bat a little bit. He can't bat anywhere near as well as people think he can bat, but he can bat a little bit, which is all right. Personally, I think when Stokes is back in the team, you pick another batsman for India, because I have doubts about the length of the tail if 7, 8, 9, 10 and 11 are all bowlers really by trade. Even if they're bowlers who can bat.
Don Best didn't do too badly, did he?
Hey, they're not mugs, and neither the Curran's not a mug either. But like, if the choice was you can play Ollie Pope or Dan Lawrence, and you have Stokes in your team to give you some backup overs, and you've got Root in your team to give you some backup spin options, or you can have Curran, I think in India, somebody who can bat basically in different conditions, and maybe block out 100 balls when you're trying to get a draw, or maybe have a little bit of a dash near the end. I think it's probably more valuable, but that's more. I think Curran's diverse range of skills make him a little bit more important than I think probably I've certainly given him credit for.
Well, to wrap up this segment, we all predicted a 2-0 victory. So well done, gents. Another successful prediction from the Cricket Podcast. Max, you said that Embul Denia would be the leading wicket taker. So congratulations. I said that Joe Root would be the leading run scorer. So,
we know our stuff, don't we? We know our stuff on the Cricket Podcast.
And I just wanted to ask, what was your favourite moment of the Test series? My favourite moment was delivered by Mark Wood, who decided to come in and block again, and then decide to try to hit Embul Denia into the sea. Really quite a staggering way to get out, and rather stupid, but great to see as always from the ever entertaining Mark Wood. Jack, what about you?
Oh, a moment of the series. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, like, most of the time Joe Root was batting, it was pretty good. I think...
It was a real clinic, wasn't it? It was a real clinic.
I mean, Dom Sibley sort of summed it up best when he said, "Watching Joe makes me feel quite inadequate, to be honest." I've got a little bit more on Joe, which maybe we can finish a bit off, because I don't think we've actually given him enough credit, and I've got some of his stats for the series. But yeah. Max, maybe if you let your moment.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because I was asleep for quite a lot of the cricket. But... I would give my moment to Jack Leach getting his fifer. I think it's a well-deserved moment for a man who's had some trouble and worked really hard. And well done to him. Fair play.
Yeah, lovely sure. Just I do the Root bit. Would you like to hear
please.
About Joe Root?
Yes, please.
Let's eulogise.
Take us home on Route 66.
Yeah, I mean, it was this. When I was doing my show notes, I was wondering whether I should complain about watching cricket from the fort, because I think that's stupid. Or talk about Joe Root, and I went with Joe Root, but it is important that you know that I think the people who go to Sri Lanka and watch the cricket from the fort, when you can go into the ground, are dumb. anyway, Joe Root. So I'd look a little bit of analysis on Joe Root. He scored 426 runs across 649 balls at an average of 106.5, which, if you're new to cricket, is good. But as some more analytically minded people will tell you, it's the process which you actually need to have a look at when you judge whether a thing was good or whether a thing was repeatable. And when it comes to cricket, when it comes to test match batting, probably the best indicator of whether someone's batting process and their skills is effective or not is to look at the number of false shots they play. Fellas, I don't know if do you know off the top of your head roughly how many false shots it takes to take a wicket in Test cricket?
I'm going to go 8.
No, Ross, do you have a quick, just any number?
Well, if it's James Vince, 1. 15, I reckon.
That's really close, Ross. It's about 14. And as you say, there's a little bit of flex in there. Some people's false shots are more likely to be out. James Vince would be one of them than others. But roughly, it's about 14. So across the 649 balls Joe Root faced, he only played 45 false shots. That's about 7% of the balls he faced. If your quick at maths, 45 divided by 14 gives you 3.2. Root was out 4 times in the series, Which actually suggests that maybe all of those runs he scored, for all of those runs he scored, he was actually a little bit unlucky not to have scored a few more. So I think an absolute performance for the ages there. Mm-hmm. Are Sri Lanka the greatest test team in the world? No, not at all. But I think what we saw from Root was really special. Yeah. And I'd be surprised if we see anyone perform away from home for England as well as that anytime soon.
Well, it sets up a great year, right? We've got a huge...
Root in India, maybe.
Hopefully. I mean, if he keeps that up, full shot every 7, or only 7% of the balls you face, that would actually be something that could give India trouble or give England a chance. But yeah.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up the England versus Sri Lanka segment. We will be back after a quick break following IPL auction preparation with the release and retention strategies of each of the sides. Max, I'm going to call you Dick Weller Roe Brown from now on, I reckon.
Okay. Not Nirosham.
Hugh Jarvan, 6 for 9 at Cockermouth. That's Ben Stokes' old club, isn't it?
There was big news in the IPL last week as the various franchises announced who they would be retaining and who they would be releasing prior to the 2021 mini auction. Fellas, we wrote an article on our Substack. What's the thing? The cricketpod.substack.com, if you want to go and read it, where we had a look at the various different draft strategies that we expect the IPL franchises to have going into the auction on the 18th. This is the audio version of that. They will complement each other. We'll explore different points on the show, and we'll go into some other details in the written piece. So do engage with both. First question: are you excited for the auction?
I think from my point of view, it's not been too long since the old IPL finished, right? It finished in November. And actually, I'm really excited for it. Lockdown is terrible. And actually, having something like the IPL to look forward to is brilliant. And I think the just how the IPL is managed and organised keeps it interesting. You have no idea what they're going to do next. And I mean, it was a surprise to me that they had like a night of the long knives, didn't they, for this? This is wake up one day, careers are like people got retired by this. And it was like, people just didn't give a shit. They didn't care about long served players. And I think that just adds to the drama of it all.
Yeah. So you touched on a good point there, Ross. Like, you never really know what's going to happen in the IPL. I said that the auction would be on the 18th of February. I don't actually know if that's 100% been confirmed yet. A couple of other things haven't been confirmed, given that we're only sort of 3 weeks away from that. Who exactly has been released from KKR? Big question marks there. Ross, that's your job in a minute to try and get to the bottom of that. And who is actually going to be in the auction? That third point, we've got a pretty firm understanding, I think, of who the key men on the auction block will be.
Well, I'm guessing it's going to be anyone who wants to play in the World Cup.
Yeah, it should be a pretty stellar year for the IPL. Do we need to explain any of the terms we're talking about? Because I am aware that we have a range of listener experience when it comes to the Indian Premier League. This will be the first IPL that some people are building up to. Others maybe the second. Some people the third.
Well, I think it's important at this point. You'll see from just even the strategies and the way we talk about some of the teams, you'll probably be able to draw out which team you want to support moving forward. So actually, just bear that in mind. As I said, the drama and I don't know, each of them now has a bit of personality. So it's really quite good.
Yeah, oh, I think that's a good point, Ross. I mean, well, I'll explain what's actually going to happen in a second. But one of the things that English fans quite often say about the IPO is that the franchises don't have much personality and they're all a little bit faceless. But actually, like, that isn't really the case. It's been going for, I mean, what is it, 30? Is this the 13th or 14th IPL now?
I think 14th, yeah.
Yeah, there's an established history to a lot of these franchises. There are storylines that basically come up over and over again. And some of these players have played with the same franchise, or maybe a couple of franchises, for most of the tournament's existence. It's good, basically.
And they've all got poster boys as well. So you can literally just pick a team based on who you, well, hate the least in some cases. You know?
Yeah, or if you're English, you can support Rajasthan Royals, which is the kind of default. They've got Stokes and Butler, haven't they? And Archer. Anyway, the 18th, we should make a distinction here between a mega auction and a mini auction. What are we having this year, Max?
We're having a mini auction this year.
And what's the difference between a mega auction and a mini auction?
Well, a mega auction's bigger, Jack.
Right. The actual difference, that is the correct answer, but that was the smart-ass answer as well, wasn't it?
It's not like Max.
The actual answer. So every few years in the IPL, and again, this doesn't always happen, because there was supposed to be a mega auction this year, and it's been postponed. Every few years, the teams have to release basically their whole squad. I think they're allowed to retain like three or four players, and they all go into a big auction and teams rebuild basically their franchise from scratch. This year, that hasn't happened. So teams got to choose who they would release. All of the teams have released some players, but not all of them have released loads of players. The players who have been released are added to the players who didn't play in the IPL last year, and they form this year's auction pool, who teams will obviously bid on. So it's actually, if you're aware of the concept of an auction, not too difficult to follow, I don't think.
Homes under the hammer, but with people.
Oh, that's a path we're not going to go down. Any questions, Max? You're playing the role of the uninformed audience member.
Oh, I think that's all abundantly clear to me. Thank you, Jack.
Great. Well, we're going to go through the teams now. We're going to have a little chat about who they've released, who they might want to pick up at the auction, and probably poke a little bit of fun at MS Dhoni along the way. That comes from a position of love. We will caveat this by saying that we do like all Indian cricketers.
You're such a coward. So where are we going to start then, Jack?
We're going to do this alphabetically, which is controversial. In our written piece, we didn't do it that way. Go and have a look at it.
Is that because that's the order they've got them on the IPL website?
No, it's just the alphabet that works that way. Anyway, starting with Chennai Super Kings. So, alphabetically, Chennai comes first of the eight franchises in the IPL. The Super Kings have released or retired six players, probably the most high profile being Shane Watson. Piers Chawla's also in the mix. And I think there's one other person who I...
Harbhajan Singh's gone.
Harbhajan Singh, of course. Yeah, we don't want to forget Harbhajan. Ross, you had a look into CSK. What do you think their plan for the auction will be?
So it's fair to say they had, by their standards, they had a torrid IPL 20. I mean, they failed to qualify for the playoffs for the first time in their history. And so in some aspects, people could think they could panic. But actually, they've got Dhoni at the helm. He's ice cool. He's one of those people who values kind of experience around. He likes the value of a team. And he likes to do things his own way, really. I don't think he wants to surround himself by people who have got a lot of opinions, because he is a demigod in himself, right? I thought they did the right thing of getting rid of some of their players. I think they've missed a trick a little bit. They've only left one place available for an overseas slot in their squad, whilst retaining the likes of kind of DJ Bravo, kind of underwhelmed. Santner was okay, but she could be able to get a kind of a better spinner potentially. In terms of what they're looking for, we have to be careful here that CSK last time out didn't win because their strategy was a bit outdated. And I think when they were based in Abu Dhabi and based in Dubai in the UAE, their home strategy of what they used to follow, spinners and tying up and everything like that, didn't really work, did it?
No. No. in so one I, word.
Yeah. fair to say.
So I think actually the average squad age sits at over 31 now, which kind of shows you that. And IPL, the marginal gains in IPL is around the fielding aspect just as much as anything else, right? You need to be a mobile team. The way in which you field, saving runs, I mean, you saw it for Mumbai Indians, Delhi Capitals. There's some great fielders in there, and they did really well last year. Unfortunately, they've decided to not go down the route of picking kind of the youth. They've already traded for Robin Utapa, who is... he's shit.
He's old.
He averaged, I think he's averaged 16 strike rate of 119, and then his strike rate before that was 115 in the previous IPL. So he's not exactly what they were really looking for. They did, towards the end of the tournament, discover kind of Gaikwad, who was a revelation, wasn't he, at the top of the order. And they filled a much-needed gap.
Yes, yeah, he came in for Shane Watson and was a lot better than elderly Shane Watson.
Yeah, and that's no disrespect to old Shane. He did. Yeah,
he is 97.
Yeah,
like, look, if I make it to 97 and I've got an IPL gig, I'm going to be happy. I will consider that a successful life.
Yeah, Zimmer frame before wicket. I think when it comes to the top order, they've got Suresh Raina back, the second all-time run scorer in the IPL. After a year out and kind of some personal issues, you can't be sure of how good that guy is going to be. So I think they need to look for kind of a star at the top of the order to partner Faf, Gaikwad in that kind of top three. In the article, we kind of touch upon the Aussie duo of Steve Smith and Aaron Finch, established T20 players. Steve Smith is Steve Smith. He didn't do too well last out for Rajasthan Royals. But there's some other options available, considering kind of the English trio as well of David Milan. I think he's number one T20 player in the world right now.
Yeah.
Alex Hales, who's probably up there in number five. And Jason Roy. So they've got some options here, and they've got a bit in the bank to actually play with. However, because everyone kind of knows what they need, it's a bit of a risky auction strategy because their competitors could like bolster up that price. And when everyone else is going probably for the same players, I'm thinking that this mini auction might end up being a bit of a mega auction when it comes to the amount of money that they do throw around.
I think that's definitely. I think that there's a few players who are going to go for mega bucks. I think. I mean, looking at CSK's squad, Ross, you're absolutely right that they should have released at least one more overseas player. They go into this auction with it is just one overseas slot, and they really probably need upgrades on a couple of their overseas players, and I mean, I don't know. There's a view going around that the CSK are just going to put any team out onto the field for this year's IPL. Hope for the best. Dhoni pulling off a miracle. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they're able to play back in Chennai, they'll be able to revert back to their spin plan. And then at the mega auction next year, they'll rebuild the team. I think they...
I mean, I suppose they might have been planning for that this year, in fairness, with it being, you know, and the long-term strategy with it being pushed back, that might have been something they were looking towards with the ageing squad.
Well, no, I think going into this year, you're probably right, Max, but I think they had the opportunity to be a little bit more creative with those overseas positions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, maybe they'll do something surprising. I think they haven't left themselves enough room to make themselves good enough to compete this year. So I actually think they're going to spend a lot of money on someone probably not that great and then be stuck in the same boat as they were last year.
Well, it's quite interesting, right? Because they have released Donut Boy, haven't they? So Piers Trawler, let's be honest, he was rubbish last year, and he clearly took being in a lockdown hotel as that the buffet is always on. The guy was not only way too overweight and awful in the field, shit with a bat, and as their leading leg spinner, only took 6 wickets and went at an economy rate of over 9 and over. That is not what you want, and he has been duly released, thank goodness, from CSK.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem for them, though, I mean, who are they going to get to bring in here? Are they going to look for a performer from, is it the Saeb Mushtaq trophy?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because you could say that they need that top order bowler, but they do have kind of Jadeja. They've retained Santner, as I said, who is okay. Like, he's pretty handy. They've got Khan Sharma as well, and the 42-year-old Imran Tahir in their overseas slot, who cannot field as well, by the way, but is quite a handy bowler still. So this could mean that they have to be forced into the all-rounder market. And when you've got, I mean, we'll go through the other squads, but Glenn Maxwell is going to be high demand of this tournament. Moeen Ali, released by RCB, could also be there. And a bit of an outside one, with it, as Max said earlier, the World Cup, it is a World Cup year. People are going to be looking to push themselves into their national sides. So actually, could we see someone like Joe Root put himself in the mix? Because he's a decent spinner, decent enough for Yorkshire, but actually, is he going to try and make that move?
I think we'll wrap up on CSK now. I think as much positive stuff as I had to say about Joe Root 15 minutes ago, I think if you spend money on Joe Root in the IPL and expect him to be a big performer with bat or ball, you probably need to seriously reevaluate. Your strategy, to be honest. Anyway, so CSK, they're left with 22 crore rupees.
And how much is that?
That's about 2.2 million pounds. So you as a rough calculation, if you turn each crore into 100,000, you get kind of roughly what it comes out at. That's a lot of money. That's sort of in the top. Well, it's about middle in terms of the pots of money around. It's significantly more than three of the teams. They'll probably have to lump that all or a large chunk of that on a really good overseas player if they're going to be competitive. I'd expect them to do that, but I think the rest of the squad, it will probably let them down. And I think there are some better teams to talk about why, and we'll get into that. But bearing in mind, we want to sort of keep the podcast to less than a day. shall we move on to Delhi Capitals? If you're interested in why we're doing Delhi Capitals next, it's because D comes next in the alphabet. D for Delhi, Delhi Capitals. They released five players, including, among those, Jason Roy and Lamachani. So neither of those players played them last year. Not a massive surprise, but a couple of reasonably talented cricketers there that I think we'll see snapped up by someone else. In terms of how they did last year, they actually played pretty well. They were the runners up. They lost to Mumbai in the final, which, you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of there. That is a good team they have lost to, and Delhi Capitals were probably comfortably the second best team in the tournament overall. Mm-hmm. Which means they're probably not looking to a massive rebuild here and are maybe looking for one or two upgrades and some backup players. They don't have the biggest auction pot, about 13 crore rupees, which is 1.3 million pounds for our UK listeners. Where would they like to upgrade? Max, if you were the Delhi Capitals strategist, which area of their game would you guess, or would you spend that million pound on?
It's got to be six hitting, isn't it?
I think that's absolutely right.
Boundaries.
Yeah. The last year, they struggled with run rate. They have Norkia and Rabada as overseas bowlers, overseas quick bowlers, which is good. Generally, a good IPL strategy is to have a couple of good overseas fast bowlers, and Norkia and Rabada are pretty fucking tasty. they pair that with Axar Patel and Ravichandran Ashwin. So pretty decent in the spin department, and they kind of muddle through with Stoinis bowling some overs. So bowling wise, they're all right. Batting though, yeah, they really don't have that much explosive power. So where will they be looking to get that? I think is the question. And I think they may be looking to upgrade on Shimran Hetmeyer, who played a lot of games with them last year. Not the biggest return. I mean, Shimran Hetmeyer is not awful, but I think they might want to look elsewhere. Who could that be? Well, I think there are a couple of English players, and there are other players available in the auction, but I think looking at what's going on in the BBL, there's one player who's head and shoulders above everyone else in terms of who I would pick up if I were Delhi, and that's Alex Hales. They struggled last year at the top of the order with Prithvi Shaw. Hales is a huge upgrade on Prithvi Shaw opening the batting. And he's a pretty big upgrade on Shimron Hetmyer in terms of utility for your overseas player. That also gives him the option, I think, to maybe change Rishabh Pant's role slightly, drop him down to five to take on the Hetmyer duties and pair him with Stoinis so that they have a better run rate in the second half of the innings. That's what I would do if I were them. And I think probably that's what they will, or something like that is what they will try and do.
Yeah, and that's because they've got someone like Iyer and Darwin at the top of the order, right? They've got strong Indian batting there.
Yeah, they have. The Capitals don't really need to worry too much about recruiting Indian talent because the Indian talent on that team is so strong. It probably is that one, that little edge in terms of explosiveness that's stopping them from competing strongly with Mumbai. And that's the Capitals. I don't think we need to say any more on them. They're probably going to be one of the smaller movers in this year's IPL auction. Ready for the Kings 11?
Oh, yes.
There's a big jump here, isn't there, from D to K? But there are no... So Kings 11 Punjab. They are one of the teams who went rogue. They detonated their squad, ditched five overseas players, got rid of Cottrell, Hardis Viljoen, Nisha, Majib, and most controversially, Glenn, Big Show, Maxwell. Max, did it surprise you to see the Kings 11 get rid of Maxwell?
Yeah, it did. I mean, he didn't have a great season last season, I assume that was
fucking awful
behind
season.
There.
The Big Show didn't even hit 1-6, mate.
No, but it was a different competition. It was in the UAE. It was in conditions that you don't normally play in.
Boundaries are much bigger, weren't they?
Yeah, Sharjah in particular. But I mean, when you have someone like that in your team, like it's not really someone that you want to risk giving to someone else. Because I'm almost guarantee that at some point in this IPL, he will win a game for someone against Kings 11 Punjab. That is just gonna happen, isn't it?
I think I would basically agree with that. I think if you look at this Kings 11 side. What stopped them getting to the playoffs last year? So they finished fifth or sixth. It was basically that they didn't score enough runs in the back half of their innings and they didn't stop other teams plundering them. So I think if you look at the release list there, getting rid of Neesham and I think getting rid of Cottrell as well, I'm afraid, probably makes sense to free up some funds for a bowler. But Glenn Maxwell doesn't make sense in terms of your problem with scoring runs. Ross, you're absolutely right. He had a pretty average IPL in 2020, but he is still Glenn Maxwell. He's still in the ICC T20 team of the decade. I just think it's so weird to give your competitors the option to buy him. Do you know what wouldn't surprise me?
If they got him back?
Exactly. I think the Kings 11 Punjab might be trying to cut the amount of money they're playing for Maxwell.
I think it's going to backfire.
They paid an awful lot of money to Maxwell last year for not that much. I think they'll recognise his talent. He can bowl a little bit as well. He's a really good option, basically. But it's a high risk money saving ploy.
There is the bit, right? Some other Indian franchises might go, well, it's all well and good you smashing runs in the BBL, but actually you couldn't do it last year. So actually people might look to avoid him. You never know. I don't know how these things are going to go.
I think he's got a track record. He's had really good years in the IPL. He's not necessarily the most consistent. I think he's had seasons where he scored 550 runs at 170, and he's had seasons like last year. So you're not. He's not an instant win card. Do you know what I mean?
The Kings 11 would have done much better last year if they had Glenn Maxwell. that is just the crux of it, isn't it? Who else should they be looking for, Jack?
Well, so I think this will be one of the big money spends of the auction. Akash Chopra, who probably knows more about this than us, but you know, we can't confirm that. He thinks that Kings 11 Punjab have got rid of all these overseas players and freed up an absolutely massive stack of money to make a play for Mitchell Starc. who is highly likely to enter the auction this year. Missed the IPL last year, and I think the year before, building up to the 2019 World Cup. This year, 2020 World Cup year, I reckon he'll fancy a bit of the IPL. Mm-hmm. And I think the Kings 11 Punjab really would love a bit of Mitchell Starc. It's the area, isn't it? Fast bowling is the area where they were rubbish last year. Rahul Tawacha was hitting people out of the ground. All sorts of ridiculous results were happening because they couldn't get anyone out with their fast bowlers. Starc solves that problem immediately by upgrading your pace of attack from probably the worst in the tournament to maybe the second best or third best.
And I don't think that Starc's batting could be underrated either. Like, he is a hitter. He's long levers, end of the innings. He can get you that extra 25 runs that pushes you past the line.
Yeah, another good point. I think there's the possibility that Kings 11 Punjab, they don't always spend their whole salary cap. They're probably one of the in quotes, smaller market teams. So if someone else really wants Starc, I think they might settle for Chris Morris or Kyle Jameson, who will be floating around as well. But it looks like Stark's the one they want. And if they get him, I think that changes the team's projection. They probably go from like a little bit of a joke to one of the actual favourites to win the IPL, which would be a good acquisition.
And remember, for our listeners, this is the team that has Chris Gayle in their midst, so not to be underestimated either.
Exactly. That brings us on to KKR. Now, Owen Morgan's KKR are kind of the mystery team in this because it isn't necessarily clear who they have released. Is it, Ross?
No, so from about four or five different official sources, as they name themselves, it wasn't clear whether Harry Gurney or Ali Khan, the USA cricketer, were released, retained, or whatever else. And it just wasn't clear. So we're going to assume that they have both been released and the KKR have a couple of overseas spots remaining. It was a bit of an interesting year last year for KKR. They were kind of bandaged together, really. I mean, they had injured Andre Russell, who, being one of the best players of all time of T20 cricket, was a major loss to them. They had a mid-season captaincy change, which didn't reap any dividends. But they've not gone full. They've not gone full RCB on this. They've actually kept quite. They've kept kept the core of players together, and I think it's quite clear kind of what positions they actually want to pick up. I don't think they're going to have the money. They've only got about £1 million to spend. So actually, they're going to have to be really careful who they get involved with. Pace wise, they've got Lockie Ferguson. They've got Cumdog, Pat Cummins. That is. So maybe he needs a bit more support. Tom Curran could potentially come into that mix. We kind of had a bit of a discussion last night whether Tom Curran's a middle-overs bowler, really a death bowler. He's just probably quite a handy person to have. And actually, I don't think he's going to go for as much money as he did last time, as people actually can recognise Sam Curran from Tom Curran now, which is really useful for everybody involved. Sunil Narine, as a T20 player, he was pretty pants last year, wasn't he? The Knight Rider franchise technique of opening up him and following the data on that one didn't work out, and that's fair enough. But Kuldeep Yadav could well find a bit of form. Who I do think they should look to, again, we've mentioned Hales before, but I really do think they need the firepower up the top. They've got prodigy boy Shubman Gill up the top. Dennis Kartik and Rahul Tripathi are not going to do anything. They are mediocre IPL players at best, and that was representative with their averages of below 20 last year. David Milan, Jason Roy again in the mix. Even a Joe Denley or James Vince potentially, if we're going to continue the English thing. But actually, I think they'll end up spending some big money on a top order batsman, so they could free up.
There are too many good batsmen potentially available to be going for James Vince at this auction.
Yeah. Poor James Vince has had it for this podcast, hasn't he?
I think KKR's problem. It's not a huge problem because they're only trying to fill a small number of slots. They've got about 10 crore available. Kings 11 Punjab have got 53 crore available. So there are teams in this auction with five times the amount of resources that they have. Kolkata Knight Riders' core team, if you like, which would include probably Russell, Narine, Owen Morgan as the overseas, is probably good enough that they don't need to be panicking too much about being outbid. They're, like you say, they're looking for one position. But they'll have to be kind of clever about it. And I think, you know what, I think they might have to be a little bit lucky in terms of injuries this year to really be an effective team. If they are, then they might have the best team in the tournament.
Yeah, well, I think they're lucky that the tournament's coming around so quickly, if I'm perfectly honest. Like, I think that their team isn't actually much older. It's like, well, yeah, 6 months or whatever. And I think that
benefits
them.
That's how age works. Yeah, that is, yeah, it's linear, isn't it, time? Anyway, Mumbai Indians. We're going to blast through this team because they don't need to do anything.
Because they blast through everyone else.
Yeah. In franchise terms, the Mumbai Indians, they have got a god squad. It's no surprise, therefore, that they haven't really done anything to break that up. Probably the big news is that Malinga has retired, I think, from the IPL. So the record wicket taker in the tournament won't be available to them anymore, although he wasn't last year, and that didn't really seem to slow them down. If they have a weakness, it's probably death bowling. They have options there, but one of those options is Trent Bolt, who really his big skill is opening the bowling, to be honest, where he's been very effective.
And losing super overs.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? He is a little bit more hittable than some of the other players in the tournament. He's backed up by Bumrah, so it kind of balances out.
It evens out a bit, doesn't it?
They're probably thinking, imagine a world where Trent Bolt bowls 3 or 4 overs right out at the beginning. Bumrah bowls 1 or 2 at the beginning. And then at the end, we've got Bumrah and a death bowler to finish things off. So maybe you're looking at Chris Morris there. You could be looking at Kyle Jameson. They might even, a little bit of a curveball, go for Umesh Yadav, I think. To be honest, though, I don't think it really matters. I don't think there's any team in this auction that can recruit players to get to their level. So, you know, they can sit around.
Yeah, they can try. They can try.
Which moves us on nicely to the Rajasthan Royals. And this is where some big news happened. What did the Royals do, Ross?
Well, by your estimation, should Royal Challengers Bangalore not be going next?
No. RA, mate.
Oh, RA. Oh, yeah. I was doing RR. 2 weeks in a row. Anyway, yeah. I don't know what they've done. I don't know what the Rajasthan Royals have done.
You don't know what they've done. They've
released Smudge.
They did a tweet saying goodbye to Smudge. They've ditched their captain. They haven't just ditched their captain. It's not like Dinesh Kartik, we're going to give the captaincy armband to Owen Morgan. It's, please leave. They've completely fired him. Bold move, don't you think, Max?
It doesn't happen very often, does it? It's not a very cricket, not a very cricket experience, and I quite like it. It's quite good fun, isn't it? A bit of drama.
I think Steve Smith's probably a little bit overrated in T20 cricket. They were paying him a lot of money. Probably makes sense to move him on. And it frees up an overseas slot. We can talk about our Rajasthan Royals strategy all we like in terms of how they fit overseas players in. But I think that the fundamental problem that they have isn't who bats where. It's that they have a lack of Indian talent. The Indian core at Rajasthan Royals is the worst set of Indian players in the tournament. And that means that even though they have Joss Butler and they have Jofra Archer and they have Ben Stokes, I think that's like 2 of the last 3 MVPs. It might be 3 of the last 4 MVPs. So I think Butler's won it as well. So Butler, Stokes and Archer have definitely won it. They're not backed up, basically, by the Indian players. That means, I think, that they are one of the teams that have to try and break the bank to pick up any Indian player who can do anything. And this is why I think Shivam Dubey, has an outside chance of being a millionaire by this time next month, which is probably not a set of circumstances that even Shivam Dubey thought could be possible this time last week. So Shivam Dubey, he was cut by RCB. He's pretty good. He can hit the ball a long way and he can bowl a bit. Rajasthan Royals need an Indian player who can hit the ball a long way and bowl a bit. Max, what do you reckon?
Yeah, well, like another team that I'll get to a bit later on, I don't think you could be too far off with that. It's one of those things, isn't it? It's like with the Premier League and football in England and buying Danny Drinkwater for £30 million because he's English. It's that kind of level.
Yeah. If we want to look at where they might try and invest in an overseas player, I think there's a possibility they'll be in the Maxwell hunt. Probably, though, that would be dumb if they did that. They're a franchise associated with Shane Warne, so it's on the list of possibilities. But I reckon they would be better served looking for a bowler to back up Archer. If you watched any of the IPL last year, you'll have witnessed teams literally block out Jofra Archer and then plunder the rest of the Royals bowling lineup. Names on the list, we've already said Stark, Jameson, Chris Morris. I think there's a possibility they'll be in for Mujeeb, the Afghan spinner as well. But how they'll fit all of that into a team is difficult to say.
Do they not need something to replace Steve Smith in the batting as well?
Probably not. I think they might be all right in terms of that type of batter. They need a bit more explosion, I think. But I think Steve Smith leaving gives them clears the way for Stokes
and Butler to open.
Yeah. Sampson will be there or thereabouts. I mean, Tawatia can blast it a little bit lower down the order. Yeah, they probably need someone else. But I think it's easier to find an Indian player who can bat at a strike rate of 125 and average 30 than it is to find someone who can slog it like, I don't know, Glenn Maxwell or something. So, you know, there's a lot of ins and lots of outs. I don't think they can get around the problem that their Indian players aren't good enough. I don't think they can buy their way out of that. But they will try. God damn it, I expect them to try.
Yeah, if there's one thing the IPL does, it's throw money at the problem.
Royal Challengers Bangalore.
Sunrisers Hyderabad next, alphabetically. Don't worry.
Very good, very good, Ross. Yeah, Royal Challengers Bangalore, penultimate on the list. RCB. I mean, what do RCB like doing apart from shitting the bed?
They
have gone mental. It's not a mega auction. Someone probably should have given the memo that the mega auction's been postponed because they've got rid of 10 players. They almost have fewer left in their team than they got rid of. They've only got 12 players left. And there are some notable names among those who have left, Aaron Finch being one. He didn't have a particularly good year last year, so he's been culled. Noeen Ali barely played. And he's done for. Chris Morris, possibly the most surprising, because he's quite good.
Their best fast bowler.
Took quite a few wickets for them. And also has a career IPL strike rate of nearly 160, which is pretty handy to have. So getting rid of that is questionable. Shivam Dubey, you've mentioned, is, he's not stellar, but he does a job and provides balance to a team, and there are a few others. Umesh Yadav was one that you mentioned earlier, who's also gone. But if we sat here and named them all, we'd be here forever. So when it comes to the auction, they have a lot of spaces to fill, a lot of overseas slots to fill, some money to do it with, but not actually a huge amount. Because if you look at the players that they do have, they're all quite good. Like, they've got a good core of like 7 out of their 11. I think this is probably why they've had such a clear out. They're probably quite disappointed with how they did last year. They've got Indian captain Kohli, AB de Villiers, who's a phenomenal player, Padakal, who scored plenty of runs, and then the very exciting young Indian bowlers of Mohammad Siraj, Navdeep Saini and Washington Sundar. So they've got a good core there, and I think with the remaining money that they've got, they will be looking to add overseas firepower to round off the team. But they've got rid of a bowler, they've got rid of a batsman, they've got rid of an all-rounder, so they could literally buy...
Mate, they're buying Steve Smith. There is no doubt in my mind that RCB are going to buy Steve Smith.
Oh my God, I hadn't even thought about that. Kohli will definitely fancy a bit of that.
Yeah,
fits the game plan.
It does fit the game plan.
Oh my god,
RCB are perfect at scoring 160, and it's all they ever do. They don't do anything other than that. That is their plan, and Steve Smith fits that mod perfectly.
They don't. Literally the last player they should be thinking about buying.
What they should be doing, obviously, is going for David Milan and maybe an opening batsman, Alex Hales. That would be ideal, and probably another bowler. But what they could do with is an all-rounder. So, I mean, Glenn Maxwell can bowl a bit, but really I think they need to be replacing Chris Morris with an all-rounder. And I think the best all-rounder in the IPL auction pool this year is, in fact, Chris Morris. So I fully expect them to try and buy him back for a bit cheaper, because he was quite expensive and has had some injury problems. So I think that is probably their game plan there. Yeah.
I just honestly, I don't understand the thought process. I mean, nobody does. There's this book, Cricket 2.0, which lots of people will have read. There's literally a chapter in this book, Why RCB Lose. There it is. Why RCB Lose. And it's because they do fucking crazy things like this. It's like the only thing, I mean, it's not the dumbest thing that happened in sport this week. In the NFL last night, a team kicked a field goal when they needed 8 points to win with 2 minutes left. If you understand how the NFL scoring system works and how stupid that is, then you'll be like, yeah, I know, the Green Bay Packers are dumb. But this is almost as dumb. I mean, like, clearing out this number of players, getting rid of players that are like...
The year before Omega Rock.
Nailed on as well. For your starting 11. Who do they think they... You can only think that they think that they're... One, Steve Smith or somebody out there is an upgrade on Aaron Finch. They wouldn't get rid of Aaron Finch unless they thought there was an upgrade. Now they have Josh.
I mean, let's be clear about this, by the way. When it comes to T20 cricket, that is not the case.
Yeah, they have Josh Philippe, who's been playing really well in the BBR. It's a lower standard tournament. He wasn't amazing in the IPL last year. Maybe they think he can take the step up and fill that space for not very much money. If they think that is the case, then what are they doing? Are they lining up like a? They've got 35 crore, which is 3.5 million. Are they going to spend £2 million pounds on Mitchell Starc?
Yeah.
Is that what they're going to do?
They've got a lot of spaces to fill, and they don't have that much money to do it with in terms of how much, you know, how many players they need to buy. So if they do go for Mitchell Starc, they're in trouble.
Well, that's the only... I mean, like, who could be an upgrade on Chris Morris, realistically, for them? It could be... It's Starc, or maybe they think Jameson can do it.
Yeah,
which is completely unproven, right?
It's mental. Yeah. So, I mean, really mental. Yeah.
They will probably do it for absolutely everyone.
Shivam Dubey as well. I mean, like, he didn't play every game for them last year, but he is a pretty dependable guy who can bowl a little bit, can hit the ball pretty hard. You know what you're going to get. He can field. It just seems really bizarre that you'd basically give a team like Rajasthan Royals a better player for free. Anyway, RCB, I mean, like, if anybody can explain that, please do get in touch at the Cricket Pod.
Please do let us know. Okay, we'll move on, shall we?
Sunrisers Hyderabad.
Sunrisers Hyderabad. Fairly, well, in comparison, fairly quick one to RCB. Sunrisers Hyderabad, we all know what their problem is. They've got some really good overseas players that all do the same thing. They've got loads of really good batsmen, which is fine. As long as your sort of top level Indian players back that up are sort of bowlers or middle rounders or something. Unfortunately, their top Indian player is Manish Pandey, who's also a top order batsman. So they just don't have the squad. The squad is wrong. It's unbalanced and it needs fixing. And they can't really fix it at this auction because they've only got one overseas slot.
Yeah.
And most of the players are overseas. So from my point of view, they are going to be rivaling the Rajasthan Royals for Shivam Dubey.
What a situation!
And that is why Shivam Dubey may be a millionaire. This time
Dubey must be
in
bubble wrap. He honestly must be protecting himself so he doesn't get injured.
I tell you, someone else, and we haven't mentioned this him yet, but someone else who could go for way more money than their 37-year-old body is worth. Srisanth. He's going to be in the auction. Yeah. Somebody is going to take a punt on Srisanth. If a couple of teams fancy it, Srisanth could be going for like 300 grand here, I reckon. I honestly can see that happening.
I would absolutely love to see it. Because that is another option that Sunrisers could look at to up their Indian talent.
I think Rajasthan Royals could do it, and which would be absolutely insane if you know the whole backstory about why Srisanth is out of the tournament. If Rajasthan Royals pick up Srisanth, mate, there's all sorts of queries people need to be making about that.
I think the Royals and Sunrisers find themselves in a fairly similar position, don't they, with needing to kind of bolster their Indian talent and probably with the ball to back up their star bowler, who for Sunrisers is Rashid Khan.
If you would like to read a little bit more, we have collectively written a couple of articles on the draft strategy and some top talent that we think each of the eight franchises will be going for. You can find that at thecricketpod.substack.com or on Twitter at thecricketpod. Lads, should we draw a line under the IPL there? There's a couple of other things happening in cricket that we should mention really quickly. Nods all round. Bangladesh just completed a three-match win over the West Indies. Good to see Shakib Al-Hassan back after his long ban. Pretty troubling times for the West Indies, don't you
think? Can he play in the IPL?
Yeah.
Because he would be a seriously good addition to one of the sides.
Yeah,
and we've not included him in anything we've talked about or in the article we've written. So
there are a few West Indies players as well that are knocking around that might fancy a gig. West Indies are not great for them. They sent a B team, but still not wonderful, I didn't think.
Does B stand for bad?
Yes, it does in this case. And kicking off tomorrow morning, we should mention that Pakistan are hosting another test series. So it's good to see their kind of assimilation or the assimilation of Pakistani home fixtures heading onwards in it, on a good trajectory. Babar Azam's debut as captain in this game for Pakistan. They have dropped Mohammed Abbas from the squad, though, for reasons known only to Pakistan. regardless, it should be a pretty tricky trip for South Africa, this, Ross.
Yeah, I think when it comes to Pakistan, we always say they're a bit of a lottery team, but actually on their home patch, they've got some really good established players in there. And I think they just, they probably learnt a lot from their tour to New Zealand. And I think that South Africa aren't as strong as they once were they really? So I think it should be a pretty interesting matchup.
Anyway, that's pretty much the cricket podcast for this week. Ross or Max, whoever gets there first, do you want to remind the listeners where they can find us and what they should be doing?
At the Cricket Pod. Following us, subscribing, reviewing. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah, that's all good. Let a friend know as well. We will be back next week. Not really sure with what yet. Probably a preview of England-India, I think.
I've just got to cut over the end of this. Sunrisers Hyderabad kept Mitch Marsh. Is that a joke?
Yeah.
Is that a joke?
And we will continue.
And Jason Holder, who they brought in to replace Mitch Marsh because he was injured.
And we will continue with our IPL coverage, building up to the auction. We've got analyst Dan Weston, who's actually been involved in drafts before, to come on and tell us why our...
He can tell us where we were all completely wrong.
Yeah, well, it's just rubbish, which should be a good podcast. We've got India, England. We've got the lot. It's non-stop cricket from now until September. I think we worked out there's 1 2-week break in the whole.
And that's just the international calendar for England.
Yeah. So it's going to be a fun time. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye. Bye.